Hello, John Dennis here on Friday the 13th of March. Today, the Royal Bank of Scotland's £25 billion tax avoidance scheme, exposed by The Guardian.
These mega deals, you have to put billions and billions of pounds in order to crank up a worthwhile tax profit out of them, because, you know, basically you're getting a profit on the interest.
Also today, the protection of children must be made a higher priority. That's according to a major report into children's services following the death of Baby P.
We can and must do more to prevent these deaths. We can bring the numbers down further. I agree with Lord Laming. Some of his recommendations are frankly just common sense.
And scientists warn politicians time's running out to stop the worst effects of climate change.
People here are saying that, you know, 2 degrees is gone. We're going to be lucky to limit temperature rise to 3 degrees, but actually we're looking more like 4 degrees.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But now the news headlines and the papers with Bill Overton.
The policeman shot by dissident Republicans in Northern Ireland is to be buried today. PC Stephen Carroll, himself a Catholic, was shot by a member of the Continuity IRA when he answered an emergency call in Craigavon, County Armagh. Hundreds of mourners are expected to attend the funeral in Banbridge. His widow Kate pleaded for this to be the last death in the conflict in Northern Ireland. She said that her husband had thought this war was over. The Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao has said he's confident his government's $600 billion stimulus package will revive the economy, but he has said that he has more plans and more money to spend if times get harder. He said that confidence was more important than money in solving the world economic crisis. He asked the USA to protect the $1 trillion China had invested there. His comments led to a swift rise on Asian stock markets. The Japanese index rose by more than 5%. China's own index in Hong Kong gained almost 4%. Finance ministers from the G20 leading nations are flying into Britain for their discussions on the economy taking place over the weekend. Britain's hoping for a global coordinated response to the recession using financial stimulus. But Germany and France say they're not interested in spending more money than they have already. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that the most important move would be to set up a system of regulating the banks to prevent the economic catastrophe happening again. Britain's Alistair Darling agreed, saying there should be backstop powers to stop banks overextending themselves. The Guardian's discovered that one of the banks the government had to bail out, RBS, has spent billions itself in avoiding taxes. An exclusive investigation shows that RBS, which is now 70% owned by the taxpayer, put £25 billion into complex tax avoidance schemes during its boom years. We'll hear the full story shortly. Football, and the second Manchester team continues to do well in Europe. In the UEFA Cup, Manchester City beat top Danish club Aalborg 2-0. It's 33 years since City have won any silverware, however. Few of the morning papers agree on what is the most important story, but the disgraced con man Bernard Madoff gets his picture on the front pages of three of them. Sorry, Madoff faces 150 years, says The Telegraph. Madoff pleads guilty to the biggest fraud in history and swaps his luxury penthouse for a prison cell, writes The Independent. Madoff heads to jail at last, comments The Times. The Financial Times puts his apology in its headline: I cannot adequately express how deeply sorry I am for what I have done. You can hear our correspondent from the court later in Guardian Daily. The Guardian chooses another prison sentence for its second lead. 3 years for the journalist who threw shoe at Bush, it tells us. The Iraqi journalist was finally sentenced in a Baghdad court yesterday. The Telegraph shares another front page story with The Guardian about a warning from the world's leading scientists meeting at the climate change conference in Copenhagen. Act now or face climate catastrophe is the Telegraph headline, while The Guardian focuses on Nicola Stern, the economist who advised Britain. It says that he attacked politicians for the climate catastrophe. Finally, the two main red tops, The Sun and The Mirror, both lead on Jose Mourinho, now manager of Inter Milan. They say that a football supporter claims the manager punched him in the face after Milan lost to Man U. Punch and Jose, chortles The Sun. The special 1-2, jokes The Mirror. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The Royal Bank of Scotland spent £25 billion avoiding tax. The Guardian reveals today that the deals happened under the previous management, led by Sir Fred Goodwin, now retired with a £700,000 a year pension. Without breaking any laws, RBS worked with other banks to claim tax relief from secretive offshore entities. David Lee has the details.
Well, it's quite extraordinary the amount of time they seem to have spent on cooking up very complicated tax avoidance schemes, rather than concentrating on lending to British business or any of the things you think banks would do. They set up 13 separate transatlantic schemes in which it's very difficult to describe in a simple way, because what they did was they spun the money around. They would put £1 billion or £2 billion or £6 billion even into one of these schemes, and they'd spin it all around so that a tax loss ended up offshore in the Cayman Islands. And then they would do a deal with, say, an American bank, and the American bank would manage to get the benefit of the tax loss as well as the British bank. So they got the benefit of the tax loss twice. It's called double dipping.
And how much has all this cost the UK taxpayer?
Well, funnily enough, it's cost the American taxpayer probably more than it's cost the British, because a lot of these schemes involve tax losses that American banks got the benefit of. And then they would divvy up the proceeds, you know, so the Royal Bank of Scotland would get a bit of a fee for it. We calculate that altogether, the American, the British and European tax authorities have probably been deprived of more than £500 million by this explosion of avoidance schemes.
Now, with RBS, of course, they were under the management of Sir Fred Goodwin, a man who's faced a fair bit of flack for his role in creating the current financial crisis.
Well, Sir Fred's departed with his great big pension, and Johnny Cameron, who was the head of the global markets division that ran all these schemes, he's also departed with a hefty pension. And the new management are very keen to let you know that they've disbanded this structured finance organisation, and they've cleaned up their act, really. And they say, we recognise we've got a responsibility to the British taxpayer, and the last thing we're going to do is pick the pockets of the taxpayer who is supporting us. So, you know, they're saying, we've cleaned up.
But there's nothing to stop other banks who are bailed out by the taxpayer from continuing this tax avoidance type of tax avoidance scheme.
Well, while RBS have sort of put up their hands, it's very striking that Lloyds Bank, who are also supported by the taxpayer, are refusing to come out into the open and say, we will stop doing these tax avoidance schemes. In fact, they're locked in litigation with the Treasury at the moment over one such scheme, which they dreamed up a few years ago.
What role did these tax deals play in creating the downfall of financial services across the world?
One of the drivers of all these securitization deals and all these toxic asset-backed mortgage deals and so on, which have caused all the trouble in the financial world, one of the drivers turns out to have been tax avoidance, because these mega deals, you have to put billions and billions of pounds in order to crank up a worthwhile tax profit out of them, because, you know, you're getting a profit on the interest. And so if you put in £1 billion, the interest is maybe £50 million and the tax saved is maybe £15 million. So you need a lot of capital to make these things work. And a way of making it all work was to invest in mortgage-backed securities. So the market in mortgage-backed securities has been driven to an extent by tax avoidance schemes.
David Lee, and there's full details of that story at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, a report by ActionAid, backed by the South African Human Rights Commission, says there's a rising tide of hate crimes, including murder and rape, against lesbians in South Africa, and the state's turning a blind eye. We have a video report on the site at guardian.co.uk/South Africa. Alexis Petridis reviews the debut solo album by Pete Doherty. He says there might still be more to Doherty than an interminable, unutterably depressing comedy of errors. Read why at guardian.co.uk/music. And Hadley Freeman on why Philip Schofield's Twitter feed captures the essence of the man. guardian.co.uk/lostinshowbiz. World leaders meet in Copenhagen in December to hammer out a global deal on tackling climate change. Over 3 days this week, more than 2,000 leading climate experts from more than 70 countries met in Copenhagen to discuss the latest science on global warming. Environment correspondent David Adam is in Copenhagen to hear the message from the scientists to the politicians.
The message might sound familiar. It's that we have to act, and we have to act now. But I think the scientists, they have been saying it for a while, and we've been saying it in the media for a while. But I think the scientists have lost a little bit of patience almost. Certainly one said to me here that, you know, we're sick of having our carefully constructed messages lost in the political noise. You know, this is the scientific community standing up and saying, enough is enough. We've lost patience. Get your act together.
And a lot of them have been saying, David, that it's even worse than they previously said.
Yes, I mean, it's quite depressing, actually. Almost all of the numbers that you would look at are going in the wrong direction. We've heard this week that carbon emissions are much higher than anyone thought possible, that temperatures could rise faster than people realised, that the impacts of those increased temperatures could be worse than we thought. It's not been a very cheerful week.
And Nicholas Stern, the economist who warned the government of the cost of climate change, he said that politicians have not really taken on board the consequences of failure to cut carbon emissions.
No, I think he said that it was quite interesting that he talked about, you know, politicians, do they really know what's going to happen if we hit 3, 4, 5 degrees rises? I don't think they do. And it's quite extraordinary for someone in his position to be even saying that we could hit 3, 4, 5 degrees, or we need to think about it, because the politicians will tell you that we can still hit a target of 2 degrees. The scientists won't, or at least not privately. People here are saying that, you know, 2 degrees is gone. We're going to be lucky to limit temperature rise to 3 degrees, but actually we're looking more like 4 degrees.
Shall we just all give up the ghost then, David? I mean, is there anything we can do to turn things around?
Absolutely there is. I mean, this is one of the key messages from this meeting, is that a lot of the dire consequences that people are talking about, they don't have to happen. We really haven't reached that point yet where it's too late. But there is a narrow window, and the window is closing very quickly. But we can still do it. We can still cut the carbon emissions in time to avoid almost all of the really bad stuff which we've been writing about and hearing about this week ever happening. It never has to happen. For us to do that, we have to take action right now. You know, not by 2050, not even by 2020. We have to start doing things now. And the politicians have to lead the way. That's the message from the scientists.
David Adam. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Bernard Madoff is in jail and he's likely to remain there for the rest of his life after pleading guilty to a $50 billion fraud. But first, the protection of children has not been sufficiently prioritised, and many of the reforms introduced after the death of 8-year-old Victoria Columbia in 2000 haven't been properly implemented. Those are among the conclusions of Lord Laming's report into children's services in England. The Children's Secretary, Ed Balls, has accepted all Laming's recommendations, but Andy Sawford, Chief Executive of the Local Government Information Unit think tank and convener of the National Children's Services Network, thinks the government has betrayed social workers.
Social workers are the Cinderella profession. They're underpaid, they're overworked, they have far too many cases, often to manage. Many local authorities struggle with high vacancy rates. Many local authorities employ agency workers. Too often, inexperienced social workers are having to deal on the very front line with very tough cases. They would like more support. They would like more training. We need to create a better environment for social workers. We need to take a few key steps, in my view. One is incentivize experienced social workers to stay on the front line instead of becoming managers. That's something we've done in other professions. Take teaching, where we've incentivized expert teachers to stay in the classroom rather than necessarily just see their career path as becoming head teachers or senior managers. We need to do that in social work. We need to improve recruitment into social work. Again, take teaching as an example. Just this week, the government launched a fast-track recruitment program. They've launched golden handshakes. They've nationally advertised for people to come into education. What an inspiring profession it is. And I applaud all of that, but we need to see the same kind of initiative in social work, and we need to see it urgently. We need to free up social workers from paperwork. Again, the government have taken initiatives in other areas. Take the police, where civilians do more and more of the paperwork so that police can be on the front line, exactly what you and I would want them to be doing and what they want to do. It's the same for social workers. Instead, they spend too much time back in the office with paperwork, and even when they're out of the office, there's an emphasis on form filling. They're often provided with laptops or other technology so that they can do all the administration that goes with their job, rather than focus on what they really want to do, which is the children they work with.
And you've also called for a professional body that would allow social workers to have a collective voice.
Well, there are organisations like Unison and the British Association of Social Workers that have been standing up for social workers and have been trying to develop this profession over many years. And, you know, I take nothing away from their work. And they need, I think, now to come together with government, with real backing from government, to form an even stronger professional body, perhaps a collaboration of organisations that will raise the voice of social workers, the standing of social workers, put them on a par with other professions like nursing, like doctors, like police, actually start a campaign to increase their pay and improve their conditions and tackle some of these problems like high stress in the workplace due to overwork. You know, and I'm not someone, I think it's easy to accuse those of us who are saying today we need to move on and support social workers of being apologists for what happened in the Baby P case. We should not tolerate failure. And we should identify the people responsible. And in many cases, of course, social workers will have been involved where a child dies if they're on the at-risk register. And that was certainly the case with Baby P. But all around the country, there are social workers who want to do a good job, who are doing a good job and could do an even better job if they had support from government. And I'm only asking for the kind of support that other professions have.
Lord Lyming has said that we've had the necessary changes in the law now, and it's within our capability to have the best child protection services in the world. Is that your view?
Over the last 30, 40 years in Britain, the number of child deaths has been coming down significantly. And you might say, well, of course it has. Well, actually, in America, child deaths have been going up. Last year, there were 29,000 children identified as being at risk, and that's a very serious decision by social workers and other professionals, and it reflects a very serious situation for those children. That's 29,000, and there were 68 deaths. Now, of course, that's 68 deaths too many, but I think we have to keep a sense of proportion. We will have to accept that if parents are absolutely determined to kill their children, then we won't always be able to prevent that. But we can and must do more to prevent these deaths. We can bring the numbers down further. I agree with Lord Lyming. Some of his recommendations are frankly just common sense. There's not enough humility in this report to recognise the responsibility that he and the government and others share with local authorities and social services departments to get better. But no, he's made some good recommendations today. I'm pleased that Ed Balls has accepted those in full. Things like information sharing amongst professionals, we need to improve that. It was a problem in the Baby P case. And now we must move on. But the key thing, not government task forces, not the heavy boots of Whitehall and the shrill voices of politicians, point scoring, work with this profession now. Don't do unto it. Do it with the profession, and let's get on and make our children even safer.
Andy Sawford. In New York, the disgraced financier Bernard Madoff was jailed yesterday after pleading guilty to all 11 charges of fraud, money laundering, false statements and perjury. He faces spending the rest of his life in prison for running the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. That's promising investors great returns, but then using their cash to pay returns to existing investors and enriching himself with their funds. In court yesterday, Madoff heard a few of his 5,000 victims tell what happened.
I lost everything. When you lose everything, it doesn't matter.
Tell me how hard it's been for you. What's the hardest thing for you?
Sorry, it's been really difficult. I had retired and now I'm forced to go back to work. My business had been shut down and I'm restarting it, and this is not a time to restart anything.
I spoke to The Guardian's Wall Street correspondent, Andrew Clark, who was outside Manhattan Federal Court.
Well, Bernard Madoff's admitted to orchestrating the biggest financial Ponzi scheme in history, an estimated $50 billion of investors' money, which was supposed to go into stocks, shares, bonds, options to produce a profitable return. In fact, he wasn't investing any of the money, and he was simply taking people's funds and using new clients' money to pay out purported profits to existing customers.
Was there any surprise, Andy, that he's pleaded guilty to these 11 charges of fraud?
There was no particular surprise that he'd pleaded guilty. A lot of people were expecting him to strike some kind of a deal with prosecutors to accept lesser charges in return for a light sentence. There's a feeling that perhaps he wasn't helping investigators. He wanted to protect his family. He wanted to protect those he worked with, and therefore he wasn't as helpful as he might have been. And therefore the prosecution threw everything they possibly could at him, and he's taking a bullet to protect his relatives.
Was Bernie Madoff acting alone?
Well, now that's the $100,000 question, really. No one else has been charged. A number of other people are under investigation, including a number of solicitors and accountants in London, where Madoff has admitted that a large chunk of his money was laundered. I don't think anyone really believes he was acting alone. There's a question mark over whether members of his family knew what was going on. His wife withdrew a large amount of money from a fund at a company linked to his investment empire just before he was arrested. His two sons were senior executives at his investment company, but Madoff has been at pains to argue that his investment advisory business may have been fraudulent, but other aspects of the business in which his family worked were legitimate.
The US financial regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has been severely criticised for failing to spot the, as you say, the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. It's going to face a massive overhaul now, isn't it?
It is indeed. I mean, President Obama has already replaced the head of the SEC, and there's mounting political pressure for a complete overhaul of the regulatory system. People feel there are too many different regulators overseeing different aspects of the financial system, and that perhaps they should move more towards a British model of having one single body akin to the Financial Services Authority overseeing the whole lot. Having said that, it's going to be a good piece of public relations for the SEC to have pictures of Bernard Madoff walking away in handcuffs today to a prison cell. So at least they caught him, even if it was belated.
Andrew Clark. Who says political pop songs are dead? The Pet Shop Boys are the guests on this week's Music Weekly podcast. And in this clip, Neil Tennant tells host Paul McInnes about the song Legacy, inspired by, among other people, Tony Blair.
On the song Legacy, we were trying deliberately in the studio to write a different kind of melody that's not really a pop melody, that uses unusual intervals. And it was actually quite difficult to sing. I couldn't get my head around the melody. Although people, it probably sounds really easy now, but in fact, the melody is really quite unusual.
It's almost like a list of reeling off a lot of different items, some of which are climate change, other which are high-speed rail links.
Yeah.
They all seem to be relative or of a par. It seemed like almost like a kind of conclusion of this immersion in the consumer culture, which you talk about in Beautiful People and things like that. You're almost lost, and there's no sense of priority anymore.
Well, actually, that's sort of what it's about, really. I went on my computer, had an entire list of different ideas for songs, and in fact, I just decided to string them together, and so it was a bit nonsensical. And then I got an idea from it. It started, That's It, The End. And I suddenly realised that That's It, The End was Tony Blair's last words to the House of Commons. And I also had an idea of calling a song Legacy, and that comes from all these politicians talk about their legacy, this very narcissistic thing they do. And so I just had this idea of politics now, or any time when a politician leaves power or gets thrown out of power, they normally leave power haunted by something. Think of big politicians, Nixon, Thatcher, Blair, Bush, Clinton, because Clinton, fortunately, it's a sex thing. They leave power and they're always haunted by something, in a way that maybe John Major isn't, for instance, because he was elected and then just left, you know. There's Churchill. Was it Churchill who said that every political career ends in failure? It wasn't Churchill, but it was true, whoever said it. It was Enoch Powell, I think. It fascinates the idea that you're so high, and then you're just at a normal level of life.
Neil Tennant of the Pet Shop Boys from this week's Music Weekly podcast, available from lunchtime today at guardian.co.uk/music. Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.